This is an Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash production.
Podcasts and many more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. You guys are listening to the Jordan Garber Now podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Jordan Garber Now podcast. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Tonight's guests are none other than Chris Thomas, Deonna Purrazzo, a nice throwback interview with her, and of course our main event interview for tonight, the headline, Sean Martins, right here on Jordan Garber Now. All coming up. Are you looking for the best vehicle for your needs at an affordable budget? Well, Hickman Auto Sales and Financing has exactly what you're looking for. Choose from a wide variety of vehicles like the 2012 Hyundai Tucson GLS, the 2016 Chrysler 200 LX, and the 2020 Chevrolet Tahoe. All trades are accepted and paid off, and child tax, pension, disability, EI, social assistance, or self-employed are all approved. Low payment of $0 down. For more information, call 204-898-3511 or visit HickmanAutoFinancing.com. Tell them Jordan Garber Now sent you.
Jordan Garber Now, hailing from Nashville, Tennessee, and weighing an even 200 pounds, Chris Thomas.
Chris Thomas makes his way to Jordan Garber Now, and the interview is coming your way next. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jordan Garber Now podcast. My name, obviously, is Jordan Garber. And our guest is none other than Indiana wrestling standout and WWE enhancement talent, Chris Thomas. Chris, welcome to the program, man.
Thank you for welcoming me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here, and definitely you are no stranger to the world of professional wrestling. You have been in this craft for 18-plus years, and it all started for you, I believe, when you were trained by... I just wanted to confirm that you're, let's talk about, like, before we kind of step into training, let's take a step back. You call yourself the bad boy. Why do you call yourself the bad boy?
Well, actually, I don't go by that anymore. What that was probably my second or third year in the business. I started tagging with my old partner. His name was Bad Boy Jason King. So we just... make it simple, we just called ourselves the Bad Boys instead. So then that kind of tagline added to me too during that time.
So when you started out training, like, what style did you want to perfect the most? Were you kind of looking for like a strong style, a lucha style, or like style? What was your expectation?
I grew up watching old Memphis wrestling, USWA, Jerry Lawler, the WWE, and those guys.
And that's kind of the style that was taught with around our area. I really like the technical style. Like, I know his name's taboo, but like Chris Benoit, guys like that, they got that hard hitting. It looks like they're trying to kill their opponent, but I mean, they're taking care of them too.
Who are some guys?
And that's,
Sorry to interrupt there. When you're talking about guys like Dundee and the likes of those guys, was there always a favorite that you enjoyed watching growing up that was a major influence to your training and your style?
Not so much my style. Believe it or not, the person that made me absolutely fall in love with wrestling, it was Virgil. He did a gimmick in USWA called Soul Train. And he'd bring little kids up in the ring and do this, like, little train dance and stuff like that, and that was what hooked me. As far as bigger names, stars that I love watching, was like George Animal Steel. But as far as who I pattern myself after, it's guys like Triple H, Chris Benoit, the guys that know how to tell the story of their matches as they're going. Because I'm more about the story than I am the moves.
That's what I noticed too, and as a referee, I really enjoy watching storytelling in professional wrestling. And why is because I did the Northern Death Tour in February, and I learned about this whole storytelling in the crowd, not fully, but I'll say I learned about 1% of it, because the same match was the same way 5 nights in a row, but the way he worked the crowd, every single night he got the same heat. And I was always wondering, how do you do that? You know, crowds can be different, things like that. He's been in the business for 26 years. He's a mentor to me. He's a really good coach. And, like, you just learn so much, man. Just the crowd is one thing altogether. It's more important than the wrestling. If you don't know how to do crowd work, then you got to work on that before working on your moves. I think it's just an incredible, incredible it's magic. I say it's magic because working a crowd is an ultimate skill.
The crowd is everything. And when I get guys and they ask me for advice, that's the biggest thing I tell them is learn to work your audience. Because the bad thing about planning your whole matches out before you even go out there is if you get so used to that, you lose track of where you're going if one simple mess up can screw the whole matchup for you. But you're not focusing on the crowd. The crowd doesn't really care about the moves. If you do a suicide dive in the beginning, by the time you get to the end of the match, they forgot about that suicide dive. They need to be emotionally invested in your match. It doesn't matter who you are, as long as they're emotionally invested, they're going to remember you. The biggest thing that follows me around, especially around Southern Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, is they call me Crybaby Chris. And I go with it. I get them involved in it. I react with it. And, you know, it gets me over by that. And it gets the crowd to enjoy laughing at me for acting like a crybaby. So
I noticed, too, is when I did the Northern Tour, that during that match, it was the first 3 minutes had no wrestling at all whatsoever. By the time they locked up, by the time the two people locked up, it was the 3 minute mark, the crowd was going crazy, booing the heel.
Oh, yeah.
That is how you start it. Because now I feel it as a ref. Now I'm feeling the adrenaline. And then I can take bumps more. And then I can go with it more because I feel that emotional connection. When I referee in there, it's a real fight. That's what it is to me. This is going to go down, and it's my job to make sure it goes down the right way. Otherwise, I'm liable. So I find it really, really, really cool. I don't know if you know what I'm referring to when it comes to those certain points when the crowd's cheering, and you just get that all of a sudden an adrenaline rush. Not at the beginning, but just in the middle. It just pumps you up, and I love it. You probably know that way more.
I've been a heel most of my career. I prefer being a heel. I'm better at pissing people off, basically. But it is, if I can get that crowd right where I want them, to where it doesn't matter who the babyface is in the ring with me, when it comes time for them to get their shine or the crowd to pop for them, and if I can make that happen, that makes me feel better. Because that means I did my job as a heel that got them to love, want that baby face to kick my butt. It needs to be. I think too many people are so worried about getting over the stars and they want everybody to love them. But as a heel, you can't be that way. You have to. People are going to naturally like heels if you're a good enough heel anyway. But your job is to get the baby over, not get yourself over. And I always tell guys, never do a move that's going to pop the crowd more than a move the baby does. Because you don't want to outshine them. You want them to outshine you.
I'm going to write that down on my notepad. Can you repeat that, please? I'm so sorry. I got to write that down. Because I'm going on tour, and that's some valuable knowledge right there.
Basically, if you're a heel, be a heel. Don't try to get the fans to love you. You want them to hate you. And if you're working, or if you're wrestling a good guy, that is better than what they can do. Because you want the babies to outshine you, not the other way around. And if you outshine the babies, then the crowd's going to see that, and they're going to be like, well, this guy obviously isn't as good, so I might as well cheer for the bad guy. They have a chance. They're going to beat you. So when they do, the crowd goes crazy when they finally beat you.
I noticed that part of what you're talking about for the first time when I was watching Monday Night Raw. And my parents didn't let me watch until later. But it was 2007, and Shawn Michaels faced the Great Khali. And Shawn Michaels, I watched him every week in 2007 when I first started watching. He was my favorite. So when Khali threw him through the table, and let me watch.
I was 14
later.
Years old. I'm like a kid. I'm freaking out in my room. I'm crying.
I went to the living room, and I'm crying. And it's like my mom's like, well, no wonder why I tell you not to watch this. Well, you can't watch it again. So fucking Great Khali couldn't make me watch wrestling for another year. And then I eventually got back into it. And then I just started interviewing the talent. And then I just that all started with Steel Town Pro Wrestling. And then from there on, you just build connections from there. That's how it works. It's crazy. I've been in what I find cool is I've been involved in the business technically, officially for about 7 years. Imagine if I'm in it for like 10 or 15.
That
was a really beautiful part about it.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, you meet people, the person who's talking about psychology, like how to work a match, not just go out there and do what you said. And then after that was a guy
who was involved in the business.
Everybody knows who he is.
How's he doing, by the way? Are you
one of the guys? What's that?
Kind of get on it. How is he doing, by the way?
Where to work the crowd, where to pop the crowd. It's really, people can tell you these things all they want, but it's more as learning as you go, because then you can feel the reaction as you're doing it. So when somebody gives you advice, take one of the pieces of that advice. If you write it down, you write it down, but take one piece of that advice each match you do and try to apply to that somewhere. Watching your own matches is horrible because you're always your own worst critic, so everything you did is wrong in your own eyes.
That's how you learn.
Try to pick one thing and try to improve on that each time. Like just a facial expression or a body language, because that's where a lot of your fans react to, is your body language and your expressions. Because if you just go out there with your arms down to your side like you're already tired, then they're going to lose interest, because you need to be up. As a baby, you need to be energy. As a heel, you need to make them think that, okay, this guy's ready to do whatever he has to do to take the fight. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir. What were some of your experiences like working with Chase Stevens?
Sometimes painful, sometimes fun. When I broke in, he was confused when I broke in. But we were all taught the old school way. You mess up, you felt it. Unfortunately, nowadays, guys get blackballed for that. But it's the way it was. It's how you learn not to mess up. You learn, okay, if I mess up, I'm going to be hit or kicked. Chase is a good guy. We've got plenty of stories that we could tell, some I can't tell on here.
Well,
you can learn a lot from him, people, if they want to. I don't think that's part of the problem today, too, is that nobody wants to learn. They think they know everything because they see the fast-paced lucha style all the time, and that's how they want to wrestle, so they don't care what anybody else wants. But everywhere in the country is different. They like different things.
I agree with that. And this is a very very true story about what happened to me as a referee, actually. When you said the words about Chase Stevens, if you messed up, you felt it. I did learn that the hard way, unfortunately, last year at Premier Championship Wrestling, where there is a very difficult finish. I believe I still couldn't do the finish to this day. It's one of the hardest ref finishes, in my opinion. What it was the guy was near the ropes, and the finish was a tap out and a count to three at the same time, counting the match a draw. For some reason, I just got overwhelmed during the submission and the pin, and I accidentally counted one guy as the winner, and then I said, no, he is. And then I screwed it. Once I did that, I realized I screwed up. And then after that, I took a super kick without knowing. I went to the back. I didn't even know I'm so stupid. I didn't even know I was receiving a receipt for what I did. I walked to the back, and I'm like all pumped up. I'm like, yeah, how was that, man? That was fucking awesome. And then they're like, no, it's not awesome. You fucked up. That's why I kicked you. And I was like, oh. Well, and then I like offered to buy them a drink. I felt bad. I felt really terrible. But I never did that mistake since. So I learned the hard way. But I think that's what you're kind of talking about, right?
Not necessarily that. That would be a hard thing for anybody. I mean, because something like, hey, you're doing it's not a fuck finish or a screwjob finish, but it's kind of one of the things. So were you supposed to get the guy tapping out instead of the counting to three?
I was supposed to make it a draw. No tap out, no pin, a complete draw altogether. Same time. There's supposed to be a pin at the same time while he was tapping out.
I don't think I'd necessarily put that on you. I mean, that's not something, unless you have a second referee come out and say, hey, no, he won. He was tapping out or something like that. That's really where you would need one referee deciding one way, another referee deciding another way.
That was the hardest. Maybe it was a rib or something, because, like, that just seems like almost impossible.
It does, because if you're a referee and you're counting the pin, you're going to be focusing on whether the guy's shoulders are down. You're not going to be focusing on, you're going to be looking at the shoulders down to see if he's got anything on the rope. You're not going to be looking for a tap out.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't necessarily say that was on you. I mean, that'd be an odd finish anyway. I mean, that's something you want to, if you want to continue a storyline, I would do that finish and just have you count the pin or do the tap out, one of the two. If there's a heel winning or the heel tapping out, I would have the heel go over with a pin, and the baby could say he tapped out or whatever like that, and you know they show evidence of it, and you do come back with the match the next show. Is how I would do something like that.
I remember.
I wouldn't necessarily put that on. What I mean was, like, all right, we were down in Bowling Green one time. It was me, Jason Kane. He goes by Jason Reynolds now. That was my former tag partner, and Chase Stevens. And we were in Bowling Green, Kentucky for Mountain Wrestling Association, ran by Chris Hayes. It was Chris Harris and Abyss and those guys before it was Abyss. But me and Jason did the spot where I was supposed to leapfrog him. Well, I didn't jump high enough or he ran too slow, one of the two. I still say he ran too slow. But I came down on his back, and it kind of made the spot look sloppy. But since I was a green guy, I was the one who was caught, I should say. I got thrown out, and Chase kicked me in the head, which the more we've talked about that years later, but things like that happen. It was just, Chase saw it as me messing up, and that's what he thought. So that's why he did it, because you just didn't mess up. You didn't want to make the other guy look bad. Because if you look bad, you make the other guy look bad, and then nobody buys what you're trying to sell.
I'm starting to understand that. And you know what? Lessons like this, I want to thank you for taking the time to share it. Because, you know, you can simply answer my questions yes or no and follow through and move on with your day. But the time that you're helping not just me but our audience learn about our business, because most of our audience too does require a lot of people that are starting out training or about to or want to. So this is a great podcast for start out wrestlers. A lot of them listen to this show because my main thing that I like is big names, veterans, and former enhancement talent. Those are my three things that I've just been in love with having on my show. So when I bring guys on like yourself, I bring it on in a certain way because I know it helps the young guys, and I know it entertains our audience because you have that much of experience to answer questions and
right.
along those lines, which is another
and by no means I don't consider myself a big name or anything like that. I consider myself lucky on that, and the legend thing, that bothers me sometimes because I've had guys in locker rooms tell me they remember watching me as a kid.
Really?
So old.
Well, I think
there's
a difference between a veteran and legend. I feel like a veteran somewhat...
Right, that's what I meant, veteran, not legend. Veteran.
Yeah, I just think you wrestle more than 10, 15 years. That means you dedicated yourself enough, and that's the one reason why I show the respect. And the other thing is, too, is if you be nice and respect them, and you build a friendship, you build connections, and you could learn a lot of things from them. And that's what I learned about on the tour, just partnering with a 26-year vet and learning new things each before every show, learning in the ring one-on-one. Stuff like that is valuable. People pay for stuff like that, and I got it for free, so I'm really grateful.
Right. And that's the thing with guys that have been in the business a long time. That, like, I can go out there and work with anybody. If they know what they're doing and they know how to execute things right, we don't have to call a match at all. Like, Chris Michaels, he's been in the business for a long time. Great guy, nice guy. Me and him can go out there without saying a single word to each other and back and have a great match. The last two matches I had with him, the only thing we pretty much came up with was a finish, and then everything else was done out there in the ring. And those are always the best time because you can feel the crowd and you kind of feel where you want to go. You don't have to follow whatever plan you made out in the back.
And I feel like it's better, too. I learned when this when I, me and Sabu did an interview. Great guy, by the way. One of my favorite ones. But we were talking to each other, and he was telling me in his interview how it's better that things are just, you don't have a script. If you don't have a script, it seems like things are executed better, and that's how you perform better. Like, when I do interviews like this, like, at the beginning, I'll kind of stutter, I'll kind of be new to it, but then in the middle, I adjust because I do everything on the fly. I think it just turns out better. Are you, like, on the fly kind of guy, or
I prefer to. I mean, and the only time I really call stuff in the bag is, like, if somebody wants to do a spot of a couple different moves at a time, and it depends on what it is, on whether I'll go through or we'll do it, because I don't want to – I like to have a little bit of pause between each move just to let the crowd feel the move, see the move, and feel what you're feeling with the moves. But if it's like a couple things in a row, or if it's something different that we haven't done before, then I'll go over that in the back. But I won't decide where I want to do it at in the match until I'm out there, until I'm getting a feel for the crowd and what they're – when they're ready for it.
Very good. And when it comes to battle royals, more of a question for myself. You know, battle royals, there's a lot of punching and kicking, but you're not supposed to bump. If, say, you're in a battle royal, someone like me, what's, like, five moves I should use and need to know?
Five moves you need to know in a battle royal.
Sir?
Punch, kick, chop. Those are about the three main moves and how to go over the top rope.
I learned all that exactly, man. See, that means I know my trainer obviously knows what he's doing. I learned that exactly he said it. That's what how it started, actually, is, you know, I'm not a wrestler. I'm not built like a wrestler. But eventually, when I go to wrestling school in December, I will make this a reality. But when I was in the Battle Royal lap for the winter tour, I went in there, I chopped, and I kicked, and then I took chops, I ducked, and then I threw them back in the corner. I learned that. And then they did both, just let us know. And I waited 1 minute. I said, I'm not going to go up now. Let's just enjoy it, soak it in. And then after I started getting chopped the shit out of, I said, yeah, I want out now. And then I got thrown out.
My
chest was so red.
I would say you build up an immunity. I'd say you build up an immunity, Charles, but you never really do. It depends on who's chopping you, on how bad they sting or not.
You know what it is, man? Is, yeah, it hurt like hell, but like if there's a roaring crowd cheering, you're not going to feel it. Like, you might, and that you might be, I might be wrong there, but it depends who the guy is. I just got chopped hard by a woman, but she's a very strong women's wrestler who's three times stronger than me. So that wasn't much of a guy my size. So that was a little bit of a stronger person giving it. But the 26-year vet would have gave me chops, and I think that's why, because he taught me a lesson, too. And it's talked about on this podcast. If he taught me a lesson, is that he said he was going to take care of me in the ring. He taught me a lesson in confidence, because he didn't take care of me in the ring. Everybody else did. He didn't even go towards me in the ring. So if he would have taken care of me in the ring, the chops would have felt much harder, and they probably will next week. But it was definitely a really cool moment, because I learned how to get through things, and I learned how to just go see how a simple battle royal goes. So now next time I have to do it, I can do it, and it's going to help me train to be an actual wrestler. It's going to be awesome.
Right. And one thing you said in there was about the confidence thing.
Yeah.
Do you know who Ryan Howe is?
Yes, I do. I heard of him.
Okay. Me and him were, I saw him at the gym the other day, and we were talking before we started working out about some of the things like that, about being confident and, you know, egos in the business and stuff like that. There's a big misconception between egos and confidence. Some guys will think you have an ego if you're confident in yourself, and some guys do have egos. But to be a wrestler in this business, you have to be confident in yourself and your ability. When you go out there to that curtain, the crowd has to see confidence in you. If they don't see confidence in you when you're out there, they're not going to be confident in anything you do.
That's a big one for baby faces, especially, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And, I mean, but the difference between the two, though, is you can still be confident in the back, but don't show your ass. It's basically what it is. I mean, you don't have to go around the block room saying how good you are. And like that. That's just that's for the crowd. I mean, that's not for the boys in the back, because if it's a good locker room, everybody in the back should be just as good. Different styles, but just as good.
Exactly.
Now, are there some guys that this shouldn't be in a locker room? Yes. And that's not because of their confidence level. That's because they just shouldn't be in a wrestling room, period. But, I mean, you don't get better either your first year. You're not going to be the greatest wrestler. You're not going to go out there and be, you know, Daniel Bryan or anybody like that your first year in the business. You're still learning. You're still building your confidence up, too. And I think that's where a lot of guys need to slow down and realize, hey, I'm still learning. I don't know everything yet. I've been doing it for 18 plus years, and I still don't know everything. There's still things I try to work on or I see and I'll look at and, okay, I can make this better by doing this. I'll always try to improve myself in the ring.
That's the thing, too. I'm going to be 80 years old. I could be in this business for 50 years, and I'll still be learning something new. And if you feel like you've learned everything in this business, I feel like people should stop right away, because this is an industry where you're continuing to learn and progress, and nothing is ever 100%. There's always room for improvement somewhere. And I think that's...
No.
No?
No, I mean... No, you never stop learning.
Okay. But I thought you were like disagreeing with the statement. I was like, oh, okay. Where do I go from here? But no,
you do continuously learn, because I mean there are new moves that come out. People reinvent different things. But the biggest thing is, like, for me, I am an old Memphis style wrestler. It's not what people believe it is either. It's not just grab a choke over 20 minutes and sit there. It's the storytelling is what we call Memphis wrestling. And guys want to do certain moves, and that's fine, but you got to show them where to put them at. You can't just do a super kick in the beginning of a match if that's somebody else's finisher. Because then you just kill their finisher if they use it later in the night. It's all about placement of everything. You don't want to do your biggest move at the start of a match when your finish is a roll-up.
I know what you mean. Most definitely. And that's some valuable advice that we can... we definitely appreciate, that's for sure. When it comes to, like, let's say, you talk about the old Memphis-style wrestling, and we talk about the wrestling now. Obviously, when I worked with Bruce Hart in 2014, I studied so much old school, and then I became a big fan of it. I call myself more of like an old school referee and kind of like an old school kind of podcaster. But what I like is just the fact about our business today has many positives, but it also has many negatives, and sometimes it's outlined by mostly the negatives, unfortunately. Look at the Memphis wrestling. Go ahead, sir.
I was just saying, unfortunately, the negatives are outlined everywhere. It doesn't matter if it's just wrestling, TV, whatever it is. The negatives are always outside the positives of things that go on.
Especially in the media.
Far less than what the positive are.
No, that's true. That happens outside of wrestling, too, within the media and everything. But my question for you was, what were, like, the big differences between wrestling, like Memphis wrestling in, let's say, 1983 to MECW in 2020? Like, what are some differences that you can kind of share with the audience?
With MEC, with who now?
I'm just using a promotion as, like, an example of, like, wrestling in 2020 versus, like, Memphis wrestling in 83. You know, what are some differences that you can point out easily?
There, but also in the 80s, the biggest thing is the wrestlers themselves. And let it out that it was fake. Everybody always questioned it. I mean, half the world thought it was fake. But the wrestlers themselves never said it. And they would defend it. I mean, they kept the secrets of the business. They didn't tell everybody and their mom that, you know, oh, it's fake. I didn't really hurt my neck. It's just part of the story I'm doing there. You know, they would wear a neck brace around town. They would keep that alive to make it look like they actually got hurt. And if they went through a table, you wouldn't see them in the very next week wrestling a match, jumping off ladders. they would be in a neck brace and say, when I heal up from this, I'm coming after you, to add that emotion to it.
I miss that.
You see guys now going through tables and ladders in middle matches and still going over with a super kick or a frog splash or something like that. So the weapons don't mean anything anymore.
That's how I felt during, like, Nick Bockwinkel's babyface turn. I felt that emotional connection. And now, nowadays, you'll never see a face turn, like, as good as Nick Bockwinkel did it. But, man, I totally can agree with you on that one. He also made it to WWE. He also made it to the show on a Global Battle Royal. You're a Belgian waffle. So I don't know if you wanted to have, you know, make it out that way, or you wanted to keep the Chris Thomas gimmick. But, like, how was that, man? You know, that's a huge accomplishment. Good for you. My congrats. And, how did it go?
Yeah, that was actually, I mean, that was my first time there. It was pretty exciting. It happened by luck, honestly, because when we, before that, and they were picking everybody, they were picking them individually. But then I don't know if he just got tired of that or not. And he goes, how about this? You first eight, we're picking you. And I just happened to be one of the first eight. So it worked out good for me on that one. And it was a fun experience. Baron Corbin was a super nice guy. I mean, I never heard he's had a reputation, but I didn't experience that from him. Kurt Angle was pretty nice with that, too. We didn't officially know it was him until after it all went down, but he's kind of got that body type that it's hard to, if you're in the business and you know who he is, it's kind of hard not to realize who it is.
Yeah, you can just tell. But,
right. And I understood them for not telling us that he was a part of it because, unfortunately, they wanted to try to keep it a secret, and everything gets leaked out anyway nowadays. But
Anyone you come across that was really good, too? Also a good guy, you know, Baron Corbin, Kurt Angle. Anything else about your experience there that you kind of want to share, maybe the way there, or, you know, just all together?
This is mostly some of the guys talked to you, some of the guys didn't. It's just, they were busy. I mean, they're running around, they're doing their deals. It's a crazy machine, is what it is. It definitely is. You got so many working parts to it that it's definitely different when you're there and you're seeing what's going on. Being extras, they obviously don't let you know everything that's going on with the show. You just kind of got your areas that you go to. Everybody in catering that I talked to was nice. Matt Cardona, Zack Ryder, he was a super nice guy to talk to. Devon Dudley was a real nice talk to. So, I mean, a lot of people there were pretty nice to talk to. They didn't treat you like crap or anything like that. But, I mean, kind of know what you're there for. You're there for the extra spot. And you hope something more comes out of it. And if it does, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
But definitely not everyone gets to have that. So congrats for that. And wrestling today, you know, well, where can people see you coming up next? Do you have anything officially booked for the future? I only have one show booked for myself, but what about you?
Right now, the officially that I have confirmation of is July 25th in Mount Vernon, Illinois for IWA Productions. I'm currently their heavyweight champion. I've been for over a year and a half now. And then I was supposed to be doing something in Cleveland on June 28th, but I haven't heard back from him yet on whether Ohio's letting him yet. So I'd love to get up to Canada sometime and wrestle up there, but I got to get in contact with some promoters up there first to be able to do that.
Well, if you need any promoter contact info, I definitely have you covered in terms of Alberta, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan. I'd like to do a big segment called the Big Top Three. You know, it's all about the top three wrestlers you worked with in your career. If you had to name three, who would they be and why?
The top three I've ever worked. Rhino was one of the last shows I did before this COVID thing. He was a super nice guy. Went out there, had a pretty good match. They were not Buff Bagwell. He was actually super nice to work with. And didn't have any issues working with him either, so I'm proud of that match, too. And those are names-wise. But there's several guys out there that I've had great matches with. Kay Stevens, Chris Michaels, guys like that. It's hard to name some indie guys that I've had good matches with, too, like Axe Allward. He's a hard-hitting guy that you just kind of brawl with.
Nice. Well, definitely, you had an awesome career, Chris, and I appreciate you for being on. Where can people follow you on social media from around the world?
I am on Facebook, BB Chris Thomas. I am also on Instagram at i.m.chris.thomas. And then I have an Instagram, or I mean a Twitter that I don't really get on much. I believe it's I am Chris Thomas 1. But yeah, they can follow me on all three of those. I'll try to be more social. I'm having a hard time with doing that. I'm not really a social person too much, so.
All right. Well, I definitely appreciate you taking the time, man. You know, you're a great veteran of this game. And thanks for sharing your experiences, not just with me, but everyone listening from Tennessee to Indiana to Manitoba to New Zealand. So thank you.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
That was none other than Chris Thomas on the Jordan Garber Now podcast.